lot going on.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the first meeting of the Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee. I'm going to call this meeting to order. I'm Representative Patty Akam, first time chair, so give me a little bit of grace here. We will get through this and hopefully do a lot of great things for the state and have fun doing it. So I think we're going to start out with some brief introductions, and maybe before that, maybe just for those of us who are returning, we've been doing our work via Zoom for the last couple years, and so we haven't had in-person meetings for a while. And for those that are new, you haven't had in-person meetings at all. And so runs a little bit different in person, and we won't need to do roll calls, which we did on Zoom. Attendance will be taken automatically. And then as it sometimes maybe seems awkward, at least to me, for communications to run through the chair. And so if we're having a presentation and if people have questions, go ahead, raise your hand. Mike will take your name, and we will go through people in order. And I know when I was a first-term member, that didn't really make sense to me, but it does seem to keep things organized and keep things moving. So with that, maybe what we'll do is take a few minutes and just do some introductions. If you could give your name and the district you represent and then your interests in this committee. And I will maybe just start. I'm Representative Patty Akam, just elected to my third term. I represent House District 45B, which is part of the western suburbs, Minnetonka, Wayzata, Deep Haven, Woodland, and a little bit of Shorewood. A lot of change in my district this year, so new parts to get used to, which is always good. My background is in the environment, and so climate and energy are a natural fit with things that have always been of interest to me. With that, how about we start with Representative O'Neill, and we'll work our way around. And I would love if we could do members and staff too, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Marion O'Neill. I have House District 29B, which is Buffalo, Monticello, Maple Lake. So I have the Monticello Nuclear Power Plant. And my interest in energy is very vast and very wide. Probably for at least 9 years or so, I've been studying different energy opportunities, including all kinds, well, everything from storage to new nuclear, and have traveled all over the U.S. And even overseas to study energy. And so I'm very excited to be a part of the Energy Committee again.
Representative Mecklen?
Oh, come on.
Oh, come on. You're next.
I'm Representative Shane Mecklen, 27A now. They switched my number. I represent the area that is home to the Sherco coal plant, so this is part of why it's pretty important to me. As Marion just said, we need to have some serious conversation about micronuclear generation going forward, but I'm with Patty on this one. This is my third term also, and I've been on energy since day one.
Representative Altendorf. Yeah, it's just like pronounced just like it says. So PM Altendorf, I'm in the District 20A Red Wing area. I am here. This is my first term, and I have the Prairie Island Energy in my district, which is a big part of our district.
Representative Spazinski, who I should have acknowledged as our Republican lead, so my apologies for not.
You just did. Earlier. You did. Thank you, Chair Akam, and just want to start with thanking the staff that's sitting at this table. Over the COVID years, you really did a wonderful job working with folks from the minority, but also the majority, helping run the committee in a very difficult manner. Mike, you did a great job over the last couple of years, and I look forward to working with you again. Representative Chris Wazenski, I represent House District 15A, which is down in the southwest part of the state. You know, a vast majority of our municipalities are municipal-owned utilities, but also cooperatives. And so, you know, my biggest challenge was also agriculture. And, you know, understanding, you know, I think we all understand that, you know, the potential direction of what energy policy may bring, but really an all of the above, a market-driven approach when it comes to energy policy is really a passion of mine, you know, but also protecting prime farmland. You know, we see with the increased cost of food, the availability of globally, and what it means when we take an acre out of real production here in America, and what that means in third world countries, Amazon jungle and the rest. and what that really means, and what that means to energy policy here in the U.S. and what that means to slave labor in other parts of the world, really fleshing those ideas out and those realities of what we do and the unintended consequences really is my goal here in committee. And I just appreciate serving with all of you and looking forward to some great conversations as we move forward through this session. So thanks.
Representative Igo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm Representative Spencer Igo. I represent the new House District 7A, which is about half of Minnesota's Iron Range. So it runs from Coleraine all the way to Hibbing, then down to McGregor. My passion reason for wanting to be in energy this year really is about affordability and reliability. My part of the state produces the iron ore that won world wars and built this nation. And that can't be done without power. And when we're talking about energy and the future of it, we need to be able to have a grid that supports all that. And I want to be here on this committee to have those conversations and how we're going to adapt and make that happen, as well as making sure that we can keep people living in rural and greater Minnesota, right? You know, when you travel my district, you don't see power lines leading people's houses all the time. You're going to see a propane tank or a fuel oil tank in the yard. And that's their fuel source. That's what's keeping them warm when it's negative 26. And we need to find ways to make sure that that type of heating and power stays available, as well as we adapt to other things. So really looking forward to the conversations ahead. And thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Representative Ben Davis. I serve in District 6A, which is the Grand Rapids and Cohasset area, which many of you know is home to Boswell Energy. I'm looking forward to learning a lot about how we can truly prosper our districts when it comes to energy with affordable and reliable energy sources. So thank you.
Hi, I'm Lucy Rehm. I am the newly sworn in representative for 48B, which is all of Chanhassen and a good portion of Chaska. I'm a mom to three kids, former educator, lived overseas for a while, really interested in issues pertaining to the environment and sustainability, clean water. I did serve on the Environmental Commission in my city and was on the City Council in Chanhassen prior to this. I'm looking forward to this.
Vice Chair Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I'm Representative Larry Kraft from St. Louis Park, I represent about 80% of the community. First term person here as well, also come from City Council in St. Louis Park. My reason for being on this committee is really the climate and energy portion. I got involved in politics to try to do something about climate change. Spent 25 years in the tech industry, and 9 years ago made that career shift. Ran a nonprofit for 5 years that helped young people take action, as it is their future that we're talking about. And so I'm very interested in all aspects of this issue. I look forward to working with all of you.
Committee Administrator Moulzan.
Chair, members, I'm Mike Moulzan. I'll be your committee administrator.
Our committee legislative assistant, Chelsea Ray.
Hi, my name is Chelsea Ray. I am Chair Acom's legislative assistant, and I have a master's in science, technology, and environmental policy from the Humphrey School of Public Affairs. And I'm excited to be your committee legislative assistant.
Mr. Eliff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bob Eliff. My primary function here will be to draft legislation and also to do any research that you may want and also to answer questions both in and out of committee.
Zane.
Hi, my name is Ashley Eng. I'm the nonpartisan fiscal staff for this committee. I request fiscal notes and answer fiscal questions and track spending for this committee.
Representative Hollins.
Hi, my name is Athena Hollins. I represent District 66B, just starting my second term now. My interest in climate and energy is primarily climate change. You know, my district is very passionate about working as much as possible to curb and mitigate the effects of climate change. And I'm also acutely aware of climate justice and environmental justice, because a lot of my district are communities of color and lower income communities that are already being disproportionately impacted by climate change.
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Good afternoon. I'm Amanda Hemmingson-Yeager. I represent District 47A, which is Southern Maplewood and about half of Woodbury. And I'm interested and excited to be on this committee because I'm the daughter of a career Department of Natural Resources employee. And with my science background, you know, it's really important that we address climate change. It's very important for people in my district who are looking at ways to use alternative energy sources, as well as maintain our beautiful parks and trails in the district.
Chair Hornstein.
Hi, good afternoon, Madam Chair. Frank Hornstein, I represent District 61A in Minneapolis. That includes the neighborhoods of Bryn Mawr, Harrison, Elliott Park, downtown Minneapolis, and several neighborhoods in uptown Minneapolis. And I am very interested in the nexus between climate, energy, and transportation. I chair the Transportation Committee. And I'm also interested in how this set of issues around energy and climate impact our waste systems. So I'll be bringing those issues to the fore and really looking at things through an equity lens as well as transportation.
Great. Representative Farrell.
Thank you very much. I am a new member as well, along with Representatives Ream and Kraft. And up until Sunday, our chair was my representative. And thank you for redistricting. It created an opportunity, an open seat. And but for that, I wouldn't be here. I'd still hopefully be on the council. But I'm delighted to be here. And I have a long time interest in both climate and energy. And part of the reason I'm doing this is my three daughters is that we need to do something about climate change. And no one better to do it under your leadership, Chair, than you. So I'm delighted to be here, and I look forward to contributing.
Representative Bierman.
Robert Bierman, Apple Valley, third term. Excited to continue this committee for the third time, and just appreciate all the work that we're going to do ahead of us, and I appreciate what we've done in the past. And I just want to thank, too, so many of the folks in the audience that have been educators to us, and look forward to continuing to learn from them and all of you at this table as we continue to work through a transitional phase in our country right now. Thanks.
And we're so happy to welcome Representative Newton from the other body.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Jerry Newton. I represent portions of Coon Rapids and Andover. This is my fourth term in the House. It was interrupted by 6 years in the Senate. and I served on the Senate Energy Committee. But actually, I've been involved in these issues since 1994 when I was on the National League of Cities Environment and Natural Resources Committee. And then following that with the National Conference of Environmental Legislators with Frank and others. So my interest runs deep. I'm involved in several outside groups that are also looking at issues of how we can deal with making our universe a better place. Thank you.
Chair Stevenson.
Thank you, Chair Acom. I'm Zach Stevenson. I represent Anoka and Coon Rapids in the House after redistricting right next door to my seatmate, Representative Newton, and I'm thrilled that you're here with us in the House, Representative Newton, because right now in the Senate, I don't know if you know, they're having what has turned out to be a very lengthy debate about whether to allow water on the Senate floor as long as it's in clear bottles. Senators are not trustworthy enough, apparently, to have opaque bottles. We need to have accountability to make sure it's clear. So, you know, this seems like a much more important thing to be discussing, the energy future of Minnesota. And I, along with Chair Akim and others, have been on this committee since being elected. It is one of my primary interests here at the Capitol. And I thought what Representative Bierman said was exactly right, that this is, if you're a curious person, if you're interested in learning, there's no better committee in the legislature, because you really, this is a fascinating, fascinating world that we get to work in.
Anderson.
Oh, call. Sorry.
It's all right. Eric Anderson, DFL Research. I'll answer anybody's questions, so feel free to ask.
And Mr. Nicely.
Mark Nicely, Republican Caucus Research.
And we have our page, Zach, over there. Welcome, Zach. Thanks for being here. Appreciate you all being here at the table and in the audience. And we've got a couple of presentations today. We wanted to dive right in. And first up, we have Professor Heidi Roop from the University of Minnesota, and she is going to kind of get us all grounded in kind of where things are at in this issue around climate change here in Minnesota. So welcome to the committee, Professor Rupp. You can go ahead and start your presentation.
Let's see. It looks like the button was already pushed, so thank you very much.
I forgot. Please state your name for the record.
Yes. Hi, my name is Dr. Heidi Rupp. Chair Akam, members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to join you this afternoon, especially at the beginning of what will likely be a very exciting session. My name is Dr. Heidi Rupp. I'm an assistant professor of climate science, and I serve as the state's extension specialist for climate change and adaptation. In my role, I also have the privilege of directing a university program called the Climate Adaptation Partnership. We're Minnesota's leading multi-sectoral partnership, working both to leverage university expertise as well as place-specific practitioner perspectives to understand our climate risks in Minnesota and, importantly, how communities want to respond to those risks. I'm pleased to hear many of you mention climate change specifically, and your concerns map well onto what we've heard from Minnesotans loud and clear. We distributed a survey from the University of Minnesota to Minnesotans, and we heard a majority of Minnesotans, in fact, 76% of Minnesotans report being concerned about climate change. That's regardless of age, geographic location, career, level of education. There's a majority of Minnesotans concerned about climate change, but they also want to see things get done. Importantly, Minnesotans want to see reductions in emissions, improved access to renewable energy. They want to see improved and more investments in natural climate solutions and efforts that are preparing their communities for the impacts of climate change. They also want to see local, state, and municipal leaders in government do more to protect our state from the impacts of climate change. In fact, that number tops in at 83%. And I think it's important to note that Minnesotans also have hope that this will get done. Given the time I have today, which is not long, to dive into a topic which you can study for decades, I thought I might boil down some key points about the state of climate science derived primarily from the most recent Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's assessment reports that came out in 2021 and 2022. These authoritative documents synthesize literally tens of thousands of scientific studies and are compiled, reviewed, and vetted by hundreds of scientists around the globe. Boiling down the thousands of pages of text, here are some key points that I will highlight in my remarks today. These are your climate change Cliff's Notes. It is us. It's here. We've committed to change. We must reduce risks through adaptation or preparing for climate change. And importantly, we still choose, but there's no time to waste. It's us. I'll just be clear, the science is clear, and scientists like myself rarely use words like unequivocal, but the IPCC states it is unequivocal that human influence has warmed the atmosphere, the oceans, and lands. And the rate of warming that we're observing today is unprecedented in at least the last 2,000 years. If anyone wants to unpack that further, my background is actually in helping generate those records of past climate, so could certainly talk to you about wiggles if you are interested. And importantly, we know the source of the problem. Greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide and methane emitted from a range of our activities, from energy production, industry, waste, agriculture, transportation, and the built environment, are causing this warming. The good news? We aren't grappling in the dark to understand what's causing these challenges. We have tools, technologies, and increasingly favorable economic conditions as far as the cost of renewable energy is concerned to address these challenges and work towards a decarbonized economy. We also have a forestry sector in this state that is actively sequestering carbon and seeking to sustain resilient forests into the future to help offset our emissions. Importantly, no single sector bears full responsibility for these emissions. Every sector needs to embrace transformation. Some are better poised to do that more quickly than others because those technologies and the resources are in place. Others will take longer because there are jobs and people and reliability at stake. Importantly, Minnesota is leading the Midwest with its state's emissions reduction targets, which include reduction of greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by 2050 compared to 2005 levels. But we're missing our targets, and there's more to do to transition to 100% clean energy. As I mentioned, Jamie Alexander is here behind me, and she'll be testifying as well, and will be diving more deeply into decarbonization and greenhouse gas emissions, and she can follow up in greater detail about that. Also happy to answer questions after my remarks. Importantly, change is here. Average global temperature has increased over 2 degrees Fahrenheit since the late 1800s. For context, the targets set by the Paris Climate Agreement aim to limit this temperature increase to 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, or 1.5 degrees Celsius, above pre-industrial levels. If you'll note, that means we're most of the way there. Current assessments of emissions suggest we're on a pathway to exceed this target of warming, with the cost and consequences increasing with every increment of additional warming. And change is also here in Minnesota. Our average annual temperature has increased by nearly 3 degrees Fahrenheit since 1895. This is already influencing the things we care about and rely on every day, from our roads and rivers to our lakes, stormwater infrastructure, and the health and well-being of our communities. Minnesota is warming, but this warming is not equally distributed across the state or over the year, as illustrated by the graph of maps showing seasonal changes in temperature that have been observed across Minnesota's landscape since 1895. Overall, we're observing Minnesota getting both warmer and wetter. Our 10 wettest and warmest years combined on record have all occurred after 1997. We've observed a 13% increase in the heaviest rainfall events of the year, and the growing season across the Midwest region has lengthened by nearly 2 weeks since 1950. Our average winter temperatures in Minnesota are projected to be more than 10 degrees Fahrenheit warmer by the end of the century under continued emissions, high emissions. We also expect our summers to get hotter, and Minnesota is projected to experience anywhere between 5 to 25 days more per summer with maximum temperatures in excess of 90 degrees Fahrenheit by mid-century. You can see that illustrated by this map in the middle that is comparing change relative to 1981 to 2010. Extreme heat brings consequences for human health, for productivity in the economy. It creates material stress on roads and buildings, water systems, and other critical infrastructure. I acknowledge it's probably pretty hard to think about heat stress on a day like today where we're experiencing snow stress. But importantly, trends over our region show that these extremes in heat have not yet emerged, but we expect them to do so soon. All projections show that extreme heat will arrive in Minnesota in the coming decades. We have an opportunity and an imperative today to understand those risks and to prepare for those risks. Importantly, increasing precipitation that we are already experiencing has elevated overall flood risk, causing disruption to transportation and property and infrastructure. And we are already seeing and observing increased volatility in our weather extremes, with transitions between wet and dry extremes happening more quickly and more frequently across the Midwest region. We experienced the negative impacts of swings between extremes in many parts of the state between late 2021 and 2022, meaning we're experiencing these things already and having to cope with the costs and the consequences. And importantly, the impacts of climate change need no passport. Minnesota's thriving economy and the well-being of our residents isn't only dependent upon what occurs within our state boundaries. According to the IPCC, and many of the folks in this room can attest to this, weather and climate extremes are causing economic and societal impacts across national and state boundaries through supply chains, markets, the flow of natural resources, and this is occurring across our water, energy, and food sectors. The flow flows on the Mississippi River, as illustrated in this photograph from the Associated Press from this year, are a salient example of the costs and consequences of changing weather extremes. Sky-high fertilizer prices driven by weather extremes in the Gulf of Mexico in 2020 are yet another example of the direct and indirect impacts and costs of a warmer world. And importantly, as the impacts of climate change mount, so do the costs. The EPA estimates that the annual cost of maintaining current levels of service on Midwestern bridges in the face of climate change could reach approximately $400 million every year by the year 2050. The federal government also released updated projections in 2022 on the fiscal risks of climate change to the nation. For From impacts to our GDP, to the cost of crop insurance premium subsidies, climate change is costly, financially and to the health and well-being of our communities. Importantly, the extent of the costs and the consequences of a warmer world is a choice we still get to make. The more we emit, the worse it gets. This illustration shows you the potential global average temperature outcomes under different emission scenarios. Of course, these are global emissions. But we know that according to the IPCC, with every incremental addition of 1 degree Fahrenheit of warming, it causes, quote, clearly discernible increases in hot extremes, heavy precipitation, and agricultural and ecological droughts. And you don't have to look beyond Minnesota's borders to see that we are squarely living in an era of extremes. Your constituents have had to cope with extreme drought and catastrophic floods, and both of these extremes back to back in a very short time period. We also know not all Minnesotans will experience climate change in the same way. Social, economic, historical, and political factors influence who has the ability to prepare for climate change, cope with climate change, and recover from its impacts. We need to center solutions and investments to addressing these inequities as we think about what constitutes an effective and invaluable climate solution or climate policy. Importantly, managing for these impacts is ultimately risk management. Managing this risk requires two things, and I can't overemphasize this. We need to both prevent the problem from getting worse. This is what we often call mitigation. At the same time that we think critically about how we prepare or adapt to the impacts that we know we've already set in motion. We have to prevent the problem from getting worse. We do this through tangible investments in reducing emissions and through effective management and planning to confront those changes that our communities are already facing and that we know will worsen with every increment of warming. Fortunately, we have plenty of tools in our toolbox to manage these risks and reduce exposure in our communities. We just have to use them. And as someone who spends a lot of time thinking about how to help Minnesota's communities understand their risks and prepare for them, we must reduce risk through adaptation. This is a statement also made loud and clear in reports like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Just as the science says it's critical to urgently reduce emissions, science shows it is urgent we work together to prepare our communities and economies for the impacts of climate change. From improved soil health, cover cropping, reforestation, to climate-ready storm and wastewater infrastructure, improved building standards, investments in public health and schools, public health and emergency response and disaster response funds and investments to support capacity, climate-tolerant crops, climate-adapted species. The list of adaptation options and their benefits are long. Again, happy to talk to you more about those in detail. Currently, our adaptation efforts tend to be fragmented. They're small in scale. They're lots of have and have-nots. They tend to be siloed by sectors, and they're designed primarily to respond to near-term risks. We often know that these efforts are focused on planning and not implementation. Right now, with historic funding of federal investments passed in the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and the Inflation Reduction Act, Minnesota could be poised to benefit from a multitude of mitigation and adaptation investments. But surveys of our local units of government show that lack of capacity and technical expertise are barriers to accessing competitive funds and other federal funding opportunities like the IRA and the IIJA. We need to bring community-identified projects into reality by increasing their ability to access capacity and technical resources to get that money to turn ideas and needs into reality. These barriers are small investments that will help our state overcome significant barriers while reaping significant rewards, not to mention a very clear return on investment. So what do Minnesotans want? I'm not going to speak for them all. I'm one, but there are many. And many of them have contributed to the development of the Minnesota Climate Action Framework. We don't have to guess. Thousands of Minnesotans have contributed to developing a vision that outlines priorities from human health and resilient communities to natural and working lands, clean transportation, emissions reductions. And importantly, communities, farmers, tribes, and industries across the state are looking for practical, place-specific, durable solutions and capacity, and the resources, support, expertise, and safeguards to put in place their plans and needed improvements that will help them shape the communities and the thriving economies that they both deserve and desire. And finally, The science is abundantly clear that there is no time to waste. Quote, any further delay in concerted anticipatory global action on adaptation and mitigation will miss a brief and rapidly closing window of opportunity to secure a safe and livable future for all. And that is a quote directly from the summary for policymakers by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's assessment report on adaptation and vulnerability. So to be clear, we're confronting the risks of climate change today, and we need to focus on both prevention and preparation as we seek to position Minnesota for success today and in the future. And with that, I'd like to extend my gratitude to you for today, this opportunity, for the work ahead of you. And as a Minnesotan, I appreciate all of your efforts to sustain and create a thriving Minnesota for myself, my daughter, and all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Root. And I initially was going to have both presenters go and then do questions, but we're doing great on time. So maybe what we'll do
the first time I did it, all right, Cherry.
You did great. You did great. And a table full of politicians kept it short for introductions. So both are working in our favor today. So if people have any questions, we can take a few minutes. And if not, we can continue with the presentation. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr. Ruth. This is a tremendous presentation and a good way to kick us off here. You had mentioned on the slide climate change is costly even more so with an action. I think you said something about bridges, but I didn't see it on the slide. So if you could maybe repeat that, but then maybe talk more generally about our specific transportation infrastructure and costs, that would be helpful.
Yes, thank you, Chair Ekum, representative, for that question. So I can't speak in detail about the exact costs, but I can direct you that the EPA in 2017, alongside the fourth U.S. National Climate Assessment process, there is a fifth National Climate Assessment to be published this year. There will be corresponding economic analyses and costs associated with that. That reporting happens in tandem. So our federal and national assessment process is ongoing. It's under public comment and review. You have till the end of the month to comment on that. We have a Midwest chapter. I can state specifically to the data that I presented in this presentation, the data that you see on your slide, those are published by OMB at the federal level. That was a White House solicited report on the fiscal risks facing the nation for climate change, primarily to the federal government. But when we look at the EPA report published in 2017 on the cost for the Midwest region, we are actually one of the regions with the highest projected impacts to our infrastructure. Part of that has to do with the amount of roadways in our region, in the Midwest region, so our costs are sort of disproportionate to other parts of the nation. We also are anticipating between 30% and 40% increase in spring and wintertime precipitation. That often corresponds to flood risks, and so a majority of the impacts on our infrastructure are likely to be tied to floods. And so we do top out with the sort of $400 million annually by mid-century on impacts, and that's just to sort of bridges. There's a whole unpacking of the different types of assets and infrastructure that will be impacted, but our region is, compared to the nation, one at higher risk for our transportation system being exposed and the costs associated with that exposure.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative
Michael. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sorry, I can't see you.
Thank you for being here, Dr. Roop. You know, I have a comment that'll lead into a question. So I was going through your slides, and you had some fantastic information, so thank you. You know, the first comment that I want to make is, you know, the thing you said, and there was a slide on it, was climate change needs no passport. I couldn't agree more, right? And I think that leads into your next slide about, you know, making sure that the decisions we make are equitable. I mean, that's one of the big reasons that I wanted to be in this committee, because everything that we're going to have to do to mitigate what your research is showing is going to require mining, right? And I wanted to start that committee by making sure that it's well known. And the concern I have, and maybe the question is for you, is has the U done any research about what the acquisition of these minerals is going to mean for climate change on its own, right? And I mean that because the President of the United States less than a month ago just signed a memorandum of understanding with the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Zambia. I mean, you and I both know there's no labor laws, there's no environmental regulations. We're sharing that global environment around the world. So the concern that I'm having here is, you know, we need to do something, but how can we make sure that we're utilizing what we have here? And is the U doing any research there and showing how just critically important it is that we stand up and we start investing in the mining that we have here in Minnesota to start making real changes in our world?
Professor Chair Acom, Representative, thank you for the question. I apologize for this chair. I can't. I'll lean over here. That is an excellent question and observation. I can't comment specifically on University of Minnesota researchers doing that work, but there are certainly a range of researchers nationally and globally looking at what we would call a life cycle analysis, sort of looking at what are the impacts of, say, mineral extraction compared to continuing on with, say, traditional fossil fuel combustion in the engine of a car. Let's say, for example, we know that as we build out and we electrify the system, we're going to need batteries and that require and other technologies which are heavily reliant on rare earth elements, right, and other minerals. That then turn into these extractive industries that you're talking about that themselves have an environmental and a social impact. But they also sustain jobs and other things. So the life cycle assessment very clearly shows that that transition has fewer climate costs over the long term when you assess the full life cycle of the impact. There is a lot of technology going into the actual recycling of minerals so as to reduce the actual burden of the extraction, because we have to, if we're going to electrify everything, there are certainly numerous barriers in the way to doing that. There are policy barriers, regulatory barriers, and then sort of the like physical, we have to get the minerals and build the things. But those are all, and my colleague can comment in greater detail when she talks about decarbonization, but we also, as you point out, there are issues with where rare earth elements and other materials are being extracted from and the regulations and the sort of environmental impacts and the human, very real human impacts of those extraction efforts overseas. And quite frankly, even here in the United States, mining doesn't have a great legacy in some communities. That said, it is going to be essential and part of our transition to clean energy. And I think one of the challenges of you all and your expertise and your role is thinking about how do we do that in a way that sustains economy, expands the ability to extract minerals where needed, makes necessary investments in the technologies that will enable us to use or reuse the things that already have been extracted. Part of that has to do with like batteries that could be used in one application and then they don't need as much energy, they can move into another application. We have a multitude of opportunities to mitigate some of the very real impacts that you're talking about, impacts to industry, impacts to people, impacts to environment. And it's a sort of whole systems approach. And I think that's one of the challenges with the way we've been talking about solutions is that we're siloing them by sector and we're failing often to look at the broader context in which that solution or policy takes place, meaning on jobs, on people, on environment. So there's no question that we need to transition to clean energy. Part of that requires these elements. And we have mechanisms to extract those, but there is a much broader conversation to mitigate the impacts of those and to think about how can we more reliably look to U.S.-based mining in a safe and sustainable way to create that and facilitate our transition to a clean energy economy.
Thank you for all that. You know, I'll just close kind of, you know, the decisions we're going to make in this committee are going to, you know, matter for generations to come, and I think it's something we really need to think twice, maybe think again before we act on something. You know, there's tons of study, even what you were just saying there. I mean, the amount of copper we need in the next 100 years to meet solar panel and electric vehicle demand is more copper than we've mined in human history. I mean, you can't recycle that. We need to mine it, and we need to be very well aware of it. And, you know, Representative Hornstein, you made a great comment about disposal as well. I mean, we need to be thinking about this very comprehensively all together, how it all ties together, because I don't want to see Wyoming continue to turn into the dumping field of wind turbines. No one should. And I don't want to see them going over to Africa or China either. So when we have these conversations, I think it's really important that we talk about this as a global scale, because like you said, it's a global environment. Thank you.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you so much for this presentation. It's been really interesting. I think from my perspective, I have some questions about farming. And I mean, as a large food producer in Minnesota, I think it's really important that we consider how climate change is going to impact our farming industry. And I would like to hear more about what the anticipated issues there are and how we might mitigate them going forward.
Chair Acom, Representative, thank you for that thoughtful question. Big questions, and many answers, both in the solution space and the preparedness space. So no question, agriculture is vital to our state's economy. It's vital to sustain a global food system. We are a heartbeat in the globe as far as food on tables. And so there's no question that people are actually very thoughtful in thinking not only about the impacts of agriculture, which are very real in the emissions space, and there's acknowledgement of that from individual farmers to organizations that represent farmers and producers to many of the large multinational companies that call Minnesota home. So there's a very real understanding of those impacts and I think, a sincere interest in understanding how do we mitigate or reduce the contribution of methane and carbon dioxide from the agricultural sector. Some of that is easier to do, some of that is harder to do. There are also really critical questions around agriculture as a solution. It turns out our soils provide great opportunities for sequestering carbon, and as we improve the health of our soil, we can improve water quality, we can improve crop productivity. There are all sorts of co-benefits that can come along with these natural climate solutions. There is a lot of concern, and one of the efforts that we're working on right now, thanks to support from the state legislature, is actually looking at the impacts of future climate on agriculture, relative humidity changes, crop distribution, the potential impacts on yields. We can see that even in present-day climate, the Corn Belt is moving north and expected to move even further north. Our team at the University Climate Adaptation Partnership is actually supported by the Minnesota Corn Growers Association. We have an extension educator focused specifically on climate resilience and agriculture. And so they've been supportive of our program and helping add capacity on the landscape to think about food systems, their connection to agriculture and climate, and what do those solutions look like, and how do we ensure productivity and resilience across the agricultural system. And again, this is I could go have a whole presentation or multiple on this, and would be happy to talk with you or share additional resources if that would be helpful.
I was just going to say thank you.
And we're going to go to Representative Swazinski here in just a second, and then go on to our next presenter. If other people have questions, let's hold them, and we can do that at the end. But we'll go to Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question to the presenter. Appreciate the time you took to put it together. Just, you know, from a, you know, we hear a lot about, you know, from an economy standpoint, you know, what we can do here in Minnesota versus what's going on in other parts of the world. You know, what kind of impact, let's say we passed kind of whatever dream thing that you, as a scientist, you would think that we should do to impact all these things that we discussed. You know, if we did all of it, and what would that be? And then two, how much would that impact the temperature in Minnesota if we did that right here in Minnesota? In Minnesota, you know, like.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative, thank you. Again, sorry for this chair. I'll lean over this way so I can make eye contact. So the dream, rarely do I ever get asked to, you know, if I could have infinite resources to do what I liked. But I think more importantly, what gets lost in, thank you very much, what gets lost in the conversation around climate and climate solutions is certainly there are costs. There's no question there are impacts. But we're confronting an amazing opportunity. And that is that climate solutions, when I think about them, it's not necessarily about a solution sitting in a silo. It's thinking about what is the public health system I want in place for my community? What is the emergency response? What are the services I want to rely on as a Minnesotan that are reliable and durable and going to show up when I need them? Those conversations, that development of a vision for what does our state look like, how does it operate, what is the heartbeat of our economy, at the undergirding all of that is a conversation around climate and what do we do and what does it look like in the future. So in that way, my response to you would be, I want a healthy, thriving state with a robust economy, a strong education system, a place where my daughter wants to live and die because it's a place that she can thrive. It's a place I'm proud to call home. It's a place that sustains jobs, whether those are rural jobs or urban jobs or anywhere jobs in this new world that we live in. And so to answer your question, every thing that we are doing right now, the way we're thinking about how to shape our communities, whether that's in this committee or another committee about our infrastructure, thinking next session about bonding, right? Climate and embedded assumptions about our climate system are inherent in all of those things, whether we're explicitly talking about them or they're implicit in our decision making. When we design a bridge or a road today, or when we decide how much tonnage a road can carry, there are assumptions about the climate system that go into the design of that road. Right now, those roads don't account for future climate. And so in that way, I'm not giving you a very compelling answer other than that I think I want what most Minnesotans want, which is a safe, prosperous, healthy place to call home. And in order to do that and all the things it takes to do that and create that, which you all help to do, requires us thinking more thoughtfully and critically about how we prevent climate change from getting worse while also preparing for it. And to your question around what do we do in Minnesota and is it a drop in the bucket and does it matter, the answer is yes, because if everybody chose to do nothing, we're facing a perilous world where we wouldn't be thriving. And certainly there are many other organizations, states, the nation, other nations, global entities, all working to deploy solutions. And I think, as I said before, no single sector, and the same goes, no single state is responsible for deploying all the solutions or assuming all the risk or the cost. But if we choose to go it alone or not go it at all, I can tell you the science clearly shows that the outcomes of that world are one that I'm confident you and I really probably wouldn't want to live in. So.
Representative Swazinski, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm just trying to kind of digest that. It sounded, you know, you had a kind of a lot on the beginning side of that and then just kind of ended. So, you know, what you're saying is that we kind of just need to just do it. And this, you know, from a, you're a doctor and a scientist, which I'm not, and I appreciate that about you. But, you know, so whether Minnesota did something or not, we just, there's not like a scientific saying, well, because it talked about science, you know, climate solutions in here. And when I hear that, I think, well, that's going to solve that, right? And so, so if we did all this, what it kind of what your dream would be in Minnesota, it wouldn't make an actual scientific difference as far as the temperature coming down or less rain or less floods. Is that what I'm kind of getting from you?
Representative Swazinski, maybe I'll just say that I think that Minnesota has an opportunity to be a leader and that our actions will have impacts on those around us. And so while we are you know, only one state and a state made up of small cities and large cities and different types of industries. If we do nothing, then that's not a way out. And so I think that there are maybe some philosophical differences that some of us may have, and that may be. And sometimes measuring outcomes isn't as exact a science as we would all like it to be. But Professor Roop, any follow-up or any final answers?
Madam Chair, thank you. And Representative, thank you for that. And I will say that while I can't give you an exact number based on some policy outcome of if you choose to do this, then the global average temperature will decrease by said increment, I can say with great confidence that every bit of greenhouse gas emissions that we avoid producing as a state and that we sequester in our rich natural resources, whether that's our forests or our soils, makes an important contribution to reaching global targets to limit warming and the costs and consequences of that warming that are very real for the rest of the world, but are also very real for Minnesotans today and in the future. And we talk about the future as mid-century. Most people alive today, and that includes Minnesotans, we talk about time periods of 2030s and the 2040s. That's not that many years away from now. And so we're talking actually about a future, our children's future, which many of you have mentioned today. But we're also collectively talking about our future and our lived experience, those of us sitting in this room today. So I think every action matters, whether we can measure global average temperature decrease, that would be difficult to do, but every ounce of emissions we avoid certainly will accumulate towards a positive impact.
And our next speaker actually is going to be able to touch on this as well. And so maybe with that, thank you, Professor Roop. Really appreciate it. And I think she'll probably stick around if we have more questions in that for her. But next we'll invite up Jamie Alexander with Project Drawdown, who will talk about this subject as well. Welcome, Ms. Alexander, and if you could state your name for the record, please. I'm learning.
Jamie Beck Alexander. It's a pleasure to be here with all of you today. Thank you so much, Madam Chair and committee members, and Dr. Roop for that wonderful context on climate action here in the state of Minnesota. So I'm going to focus now on solutions, climate solutions, and kind of digging more deeply into, you know, based on the groundwork that Dr. Roop laid for us. And just on a personal note, I will say that I have a 5 and 7 year old, and I lived in Northern California for most of my kids' early years, and moved away from Northern California because of the wildfires and moved to Minnesota. I consider myself a climate migrant. I know the topic of today's session is not on climate migration, but I think it underscores, and I will say I'm by far, you know, not the only person that is thinking about leaving other parts of the world and moving here because of climate change. So I think that underscores the importance of this conversation, the importance of Minnesota taking a leadership position, the importance of planning for these moves that we will be seeing here in the United States and in the world. So thank you again for having me. So as you heard earlier from Dr. Roop, the science has been clear for decades that we know what is causing climate change, and we're starting to see the effects here in the state of Minnesota. Oh, sorry. Oh, thank you. Is this better? Oh, sorry. Is this okay? Thank you. So we're starting to see the impacts here in the state of Minnesota now, after seeing it play out around the world in other frontline communities. So, you know, we've heard a lot about, and I think, you know, that over the course of the last few decades, there's been a lot of focus on the problem, right? And that's understandable. It's a big, massive problem. But that has turned into, you know, there's been a lot of sort of vilifying, you know, what is the source of the problem? Who are the bad guys? How do we, you know, what's this like horrible thing that we're facing? And that's, you know, that's all important to understand how big this problem is and what the sources of the problem are. But now it's time to come together and focus on solutions. And that's really the focus of the organization that I work for, Project Drawdown. And in the climate solutions space, you will also see, as I think, you know, we kind of touched on earlier in Dr. Roop's presentation, you'll see a lot of like competing claims and competing agendas, like nuclear is the only answer, or no, is carbon sequestration, and, you know, we'll be able to suck carbon out of the air someday, or capitalism is the problem, we need to tear down capitalism. And we're starting to see in the climate space this, you know, factioning over what the most important solutions are. And we need everything, but the science can really guide us to show us, you know, from a neutral place, where are the biggest cuts in emissions that we can see. And so that's really the role that we play, as a, you know, nonpartisan, arbiter of climate solutions based on the data, based on what the atmosphere and the earth is showing us to be true. So Project Drawdown is a nonprofit organization. We put out this book in 2017 that was a New York Times bestseller, really kind of, I think, showing the world that we have the solutions in front of us. Now it's a matter of scaling those climate solutions in the world. So to understand what the solutions to climate change are, we first set out to, you know, it's first important to understand where greenhouse gases are coming from. And just to reiterate what Dr. Roop shared earlier, we know where greenhouse gases are coming from. And these numbers are global. What I'm providing now is global. It's not Minnesota-specific numbers. But globally, electricity production is the biggest source of emissions. But not far behind is food, agriculture, and land use almost equal with electricity production globally in terms of sources of emissions. And then we have industry. This is things like, you know, manufacturing cars and computers. Transportation globally is, you know, 14% of our global emissions. Here in the United States, it's a much bigger share. And in fact, the biggest source of emissions in the United States. And then buildings. So looking at, you know, energy usage in our buildings, and then other energy related emissions. So understanding where the emissions come from is an important first step. And again, you can, on our website, all of this information is available for free, but you can also sort of dig in more deeply to look at more specific sources of emissions within this picture. So understanding where emissions are coming from is a critical first step. Then we look at what are solutions that we can shift to in each of those sectors so that we can continue the way of life that we've built for ourselves. We can continue doing things and even improving upon our existing systems in ways that are compatible with a thriving planet. So in the electricity sector, again, beginning with the biggest source of emissions, we need to, you know, shift the production of our electricity, enhance the efficiency of our buildings and our homes so that we need less electricity to begin with. In the food and agriculture and land use space, there's lots of solutions around shifting, you know, addressing food waste. Right now, one third of the world's food is never eaten. That's a crazy statistic. That is food that was grown, that farmers put their time and labor and love into, that was shipped around the world, that, you know, that food was never eaten. Those were wasted emissions, wasted time. You know, that's low-hanging fruit. That's an easily solvable problem. Shifting our diets toward, you know, more plant-rich diets, preserving our ecosystems. I could go on. There's lots of solutions here. I'm not going to go into each of these today, but we'll kind of just show at a high level that we know where the solutions are, and we also know their relative size. And the amount of greenhouse gas reduction potential each of them has. You can also look at, you know, sort of what is the relative level of emissions reductions that we can see with various solutions. So rooftop solar, for example, this is ranked in terms of emissions reductions potential. Rooftop solar is the 10th most impactful solution. You know, you can see the relative size of reduced carbon emissions we would see from that, how much it costs globally, but then how much, what the savings are that we would see over time, what the return on investment of those solutions are. So that helps us make the case to you know, CFOs of big companies or policymakers, like these solutions, they may cost money today, but if you take the long view, we'll see a tremendous amount of savings. I will move next to, I'm not going to go through all of these today, but so we know the what. We know what the solutions are. We know the nouns. We know we sort of like have the ingredients for this meal we're trying to build, but we haven't until recently had the recipe. We haven't had the verbs, like how do we put all of these solutions together to be able to scale climate solutions in the world quickly, safely, and equitably. How do we do that? We know what the solutions are, but how do we scale them in the world? That's the focus of ours right now. And so the science can guide us here too. The science can tell us why urgency is so paramount. So one thing that is a recent learning of ours is that, you know, the science actually shows us that carbon has a time value, similar to the time value of money. $1 invested today is worth a lot more than $1 invested a year from now because of the interest that $1 accrues over time. Similarly with carbon, you can see here the red line is sort of is our current global emissions, and then that circle is where we are today. We need to see a really steep drop, a really steep reduction in our emissions. If we do, if we bend that curve like we need to, you can see in the blue here, these are avoided emissions that we will not have to make up for later. So it's sort of like if you're trying to lose 10 pounds in 2 months, you don't start your exercise regimen 2 days before you're going to get on the scale. You start it now so that your change in behavior has time to work. Similarly with carbon emissions. If we reduce or avoid emissions today, those emissions will have less time you know, in the atmosphere. They'll you know, wreak less destruction, less extreme weather events, et cetera, and less that we'll have to, less work that we'll have to do in the future. The science also shows us how climate solutions can be deployed across time and how to prioritize. This gets to the question that was asked earlier. How do we prioritize? How do we know where we need policymaking, where we need investment, where we need business practice change, where we need behavior change? We have limited time, so we can be pretty strategic about what solutions to focus on when. Again, so this chart here shows us, the red line again is where our carbon emissions are now. And at that first circle, you see we need to bend that curve. How in the world are we supposed to see these steep cuts in emissions in such a limited amount of time? Well, we have, you know, what we call emergency brake solutions. So overall, we've analyzed 100 solutions. But there are some that are really super powerful and potent. And if we need to, you know, really dramatically bend that curve, we can pull what we call emergency brakes. And again, these are global solutions. So what it looks like in the state of Minnesota will be different than what it looks like in Africa or other, you know, other parts of the world. But emergency brake solutions are those solutions that can have a very, very immediate impact on our emissions. On our overall emissions. Those are things like slowing ecosystem degradation. So it's not about planting trees that in 20 years will absorb carbon, but it's about not cutting down the boreal forests and the, you know, those ecosystems that are doing really important work for us, absorbing the CO2 that is, you know, that's already in the that we've already put out into the air. Cutting methane leaks. Methane is an extremely potent greenhouse gas, contributing greatly to global warming. Cutting and fixing those methane leaks with technology we have today, we know where those methane leaks are coming from. Fixing those so that methane is not going into the atmosphere is a huge important solution that we should focus on this decade. Dramatic gains in energy efficiency. Again, if we, you know, especially I live up in Duluth. The more we focus on energy efficiency, the less, you know, the lower our bills and the less energy we need to use in the first place. And then lastly, cutting food waste and shifting diets. So these are sort of the very, you know, the immediate solutions that we can focus on right now while we do the work of building the infrastructure that we need for the future. So these are things like, you know, laying the groundwork for, you know, a reliable electrical grid, transportation infrastructure that enables more high-speed rail, so we don't all have to be in our personally owned vehicles all the time. So building these new low carbon systems, we need to focus on that now, but we may not see the emissions reductions cuts today from that the way we will in these with the emergency brake solutions. Then also solutions like social intervention, so protecting the rights of indigenous and native people to have their own land tenure, to own their own land. That's a climate solution because, you know, research shows that they will prevent their land from being, you know, destroyed and used for other purposes. And, you know, the equitable health care and education for women and girls around the world is a climate solution. It's a human right, and it's also a climate solution because educated women tend to make different decisions about the size of their families. They tend to be smallholder farmers in certain parts of the world. And then lastly, nature-based and new technologies, nature-based carbon removal and new technologies like carbon removal. Those are things that we will need. We will need to be able to sequester carbon and be able to have carbon dioxide removal projects. But those are not, you know, I think what you're seeing from certain parts from the tech sector and also from the federal government, massive investments in carbon dioxide removal technologies, that's actually a pretty small part of the pie when you actually look at what we need to do. The vast focus of our efforts should be on reduction and avoidance and then making up what we have to with new technologies in the future. Then the science can also show us, you know, where there are what we call win-win solutions. So climate solutions are not just climate solutions. They are often things that actually help us build the world we want to live in anyway. So they'll be good for human health. They'll help us address, you know, improve equity. They'll help us, you know, that they create good-paying jobs. And so We did an analysis last year looking at our 100 climate solutions that we've analyzed to really look at where are there win-win solutions that also help address other things. So these are things like, like installing an induction stove and removing your gas stove. That actually really helps with indoor air quality. I have a kid with severe asthma, and that makes a huge difference in our home. There are things, restoring and protecting ecosystem provides income and work, food, water, and sanitation. So you can, toward the question that was asked earlier, there are solutions that are not just climate solutions. They also help us address other things that we want for the world anyway. So all of the information that I provided today is global, and our research at Project Drawdown is global in nature, so really looking at the global atmospheric perspective, and so the data that we've provided is global, but there are efforts. This is one that is on the screen now. Drawdown Georgia is an example of the state of Georgia that took the Drawdown solutions and applied it specifically to their state, looking at their state's infrastructure, capacities of their workforce, their natural, their natural ecosystems, and then creating kind of a climate strategy based on their own unique context. And then up in Duluth, we have the Citizens Climate Action Plan, which was a similar effort to really look at what is our unique, what are the skills and the resources that we have in the Northland that that are most relevant for our climate action work. I'll just end by saying, I think we don't have to be out on a limb. I think to date we've really been in the climate community has really sort of been like throwing things at the wall, just like let's try everything. And we do. We need a lot of solutions at once. But the science can really provide us with more strategic direction. We have very limited time. We have very limited resources to do what needs to be done. And so being grounded in the science can really help us, get very strategic around where to focus and how to get there. So thank you so much for your time. It's really an honor to have been with all of you today. Thank you for your work.
Thank you, Ms. Alexander. I appreciate it. And questions from members? I think we have one from Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Alexander, right? Yeah, thanks. Just kind of two questions. In your presentation, you talked a little bit about shifting diets. Now, are you talking just like have people eat less at McDonald's and more at Burger King, or kind of what are you thinking? What are you thinking there?
A great question, Representative. Thank you. That's really all about more kind of plant-rich diets. We know that plant-rich diets tend to be less carbon intensive than those that are meat heavy. The process of the farming, the ranching that's done is very carbon intensive. And so there are different practices. There's, regenerative agriculture. There's different kinds of farming that can enable more sustainable meat production, but really shifting toward more plants and less meat is as a general rule is a climate solution.
Just from us, what kind of percent of reduction in those particular areas you think would kind of make a big difference, as far as consumption and how much is being produced versus what would kind of make a major impact from your scientific perspective?
So, great question, Representative. I am not a scientist. I should have said that at the outset, but that's a great question. I don't know what, I think there, as Dr. Roop said earlier, this is all about, it's a very challenging thing to quantify. The more action that we take, the better. There's an inverse relationship between, the emissions in our atmosphere and there's a direct correlation between the emissions that we put into the atmosphere and the extreme weather events that we see. So how much meat produced or avoided will correlate with a specific change in our temperature, I don't know. But it's a, we can provide the global picture, and the global picture is clear. Beyond that.
This is rough. It's
actually yeah. Dr.
Sure.
Oh, please.
Come on. We got two chairs. Please just state your name again for the record.
Dr. Heidi Roop, University of Minnesota. The
IPCC puts a global number on it, and it's about a 25% reduction, one meal a week-ish of meat, yields significant emissions reductions equivalent to some major industry. So it's sort of like one meal, one hamburger, 25% less than what you would normally put on your plate is about the dietary, what is desired by the IPCC. And I will note that the health community that also contributes to that report notes that there are significant health outcomes that come alongside that reduction in meat consumption. So your doctor will be happy too.
Thank you. Yeah, and just Dr. Rupp, I can call you Dr. Rupp, right? Sorry, you are a scientist, but you kind of mentioned kind of the health side of things, and it was mentioned by Mrs. Alexander, kind of talking a little bit about the kind of healthcare aspect and kind of, you know, pushing that across the globe, women's health particularly, I think you mentioned. Kind of just what do you, you know, and how do you quantify kind of that from a scientific standpoint? You said, you know, if we're able to push that, you know, globally and expand it, you know, kind of how that would affect and kind of what would that mean potentially to things, and from a scientific but a emission standard, but also just kind of a, you know, kind of feet on the ground type of a number.
Thank you, Representative. Are you referring to the health and education that I mentioned in sort of reproductive health care and education of women and girls? Yeah, that's a challenge. That is, you know, as most things in this space are, it's a challenging thing to put a number on. That's a longer term important solution. So we know that where women are, you know, have access to equitable reproductive health care, and when they have access to education, they tend to make different decisions about the size of their families. I think I mentioned that women in many lesser developed countries tend to be the farmer for smallholder farms, and so more education correlates with higher farm yields, using less land but yielding more food, and so those are cascading impacts over time. As those women take care of their households, make different decisions about the size of their families, that has implications and ripple effects across the entire system of solutions that we analyze, and that, you know, eventually is relevant for population size, but really the focus of ours is on this is a fundamental human right to have access to healthcare and education. What number? I don't know, Dr. Rupp, if you have a sense of numbers or relative size, but for us, I mean, that is a very sizable one, because it then, you know, addresses all of the other solutions as well in terms of reducing demand on our global supply.
You kind of think you might have a number. What do you think that, you know, number wise from your perspective and the research that you've done? You have kind of a rough number? Or?
A number in terms of the relative size.
You know, by that, yeah.
It's one of the top. It's one of the most important solutions that we have. One of the most important climate solutions, and I would, you know, I would bucket that with not only healthcare and education for women and girls, but also, you know, the rights of indigenous and you know, our Native American tribes to have access to their and ownership of their own land. Research shows that they are, you know, the stewards of their own land and prevent it from being deforested. So there are other, you know, these are social interventions, but they have cascading impacts for climate change. And I would say it's in the top 10 of our solutions. I couldn't quantify what you know, what CO2 reduction specifically we would see.
Sure.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have so many thoughts and ideas. I'm going to try to consolidate, but one slide that you skipped over was about, you called it refrigeration, but really it's indoor air conditioning, which is number one on the list. And when I have traveled globally, that is a huge impact that we don't do here in the United States, which is turn off air conditioning in the summer. Or in down the south all year, depending on how far south you are. But if you go to Germany, which I have on occasion, they don't really use much air conditioning. So I thought that was an interesting slide to skip over, because we Americans really love our air conditioning. As you came into this room, and it was very cool, not that we had air conditioning, but
The other thing I saw that was kind of missed is talking about grasslands and how impactful grasslands as opposed to reforestation is actually on the environment. And so if you want to talk a little bit about the sequestration of carbon in grasslands, it's double, triple, maybe even quadruple what it is with a forest. And then the last thing I'd like for you to address is when I was in Taiwan recently on a diplomatic mission, because Minnesota has a friendship with, we have a friendship caucus with Taiwan, so I just was there on a diplomatic mission with Representative Mahmoud Noor and Senator Rarick. And when we were there, we met some folks from Illinois because we were there with Midwest legislators. And the gentleman from Illinois talked about an amazing opportunity that I'm hoping that the two of these wonderful women know something about, which is a brand new operation that is underway and in planning in Illinois that will be probably the first commercial recycling facility for solar panels. Because as you know, if you've served any time on this committee, there is no global place to recycle solar panels efficiently at a commercial level. When I was at Idaho Falls, the Energy National Laboratory, the director there reiterated the fact that we have a growing problem. As you know, if you know anything about solar installation, at least 5% of those solar panels are damaged in transit and so go directly to a landfill because there isn't any other option. So I'm wondering if you could speak just briefly, one, about the power of grasslands and what are you know, what's you doing in developing and restoring grasslands, which is much more powerful than forest. And then also if you know about this new facility that is in development and underway in Illinois. Thank you.
Ms. Alexander.
Thank you, Representative. I'll start with a global picture and then pass it to Dr. Roop for the Illinois question specifically. But thank you for calling out the refrigerant solution. I skipped over that one just to, you know, kind of give a broad sense of the solutions. But refrigeration, you know, that's air conditioners and refrigerators and the leak, you know, the stuff that comes out of it, especially at the end of life of air conditioners and refrigerators is really potent. So how we dispose of refrigerants at the end of life is really important. And it is a highly impactful solution. So thank you for that. And then your question about grassland. So we look at forest ecosystem protection and restoration broadly, and so included in that is grasslands, peatlands, mangroves, forests, and then even ocean climate sinks and you know, there's seagrass, and so we look at all of that together as natural climate solutions, and that is a huge and very important solution, importantly, to protect and restore those ecosystems. And we kind of distinguish between protecting and restoring what we already have versus going out and planting new, you know, a trillion new trees, which is, it's important, you know, to plant new trees and to create new ecosystems that will absorb carbon. But those ecosystems will only start absorbing carbon in, like, trees, for example, in 20 to 30 years once they are mature. Protecting those ecosystems that are already around and already absorbing carbon is even more important. So thank you for calling that out. And I'll pass to Dr. Roop on the recycling question.
Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you, Representative, for that question. I am not familiar with that, but I am very keen to learn and look into that. That sounds really exciting, I think, and to the question that we discussed earlier around sort of mining and minerals and accessibility. I mean, that recycling question and thinking about how to deploy solutions at scale is really going to be essential to this transition, right? We're not talking about an on-off switch, right? A lot of these things don't and cannot happen overnight. Some of them that we discussed, you know, these emergency break situations, some of those, you know, we're talking about a time frame of years and decades. And I think thinking about these investments and learning from our peer states and then, dare I say, doing better is a great opportunity to, again, address a range of impacts on our economy, our Minnesota jobs, and thinking about how to be a partner and a contributor to the solution space in our region, nationally, and globally. And I will say to the question related to grasslands, it's a fantastic question. And the Nature Conservancy in, I think, 2019 or 2020, and I can send you the report. I actually referenced it for my preparing my remarks, but I was unable to include it due to time. But they've outlined a range of the natural climate solutions and their benefits benefits specifically in Minnesota, the emissions avoided and the emissions reduced through investing in the preservation of our grasslands, reforestation. They discuss in there protecting histosols, so our sort of cultivated soils and peatlands, and they actually provide numbers and derive quantitative estimates for different interventions in natural climate solutions specifically in the state of Minnesota. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but that work has been done, and I will say there are some questions that still remain unanswered, specifically related to peatlands and other things that we're really trying to resolve and think about, you know, what are the benefits of and what can we get as far as both the emissions reductions as well as some of those co-benefits related to protection of water quality and the natural environment. So those numbers exist, and I'd be happy to send you that report if it'd be helpful.
Any follow-up, Representative O'Neill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would be just thrilled to get more information about some of those things because I think they're rarely, if never, talked about, or you know, rarely talked about, maybe. And even in the presentation, we talked about reforestation, and you know, and coming from a father and a grandfather who were nurserymen, so they grew trees for a living. that was certainly an impact, and it does impact the climate, but. We just hardly ever talk about some of these other things that impact it so much more. So I just wanted to hear if they had numbers, and I'd love to get that back. And we also have an emerging crisis, really, with solar panels that were kind of at the beginning of the crisis, because even as they're putting up a brand new solar field, 5% of those are going to be destroyed and landfilled by the time they, you know, before even getting installed. And so having some place where we can actually recycle them and recapture those precious metals and, I would say, not leach into the ground the toxic metals inside, lead, cadmium, and others, I think are something that we absolutely need to pay attention to if that's the direction we're going to go. So thank you, Madam Chair.
And I will just say several of us are also on the Sustainable Infrastructure Committee, and this morning we had a great presentation about the IIJA and the IRA, and there's some great opportunities for partnerships all across the state with communities and offering capacity and expertise to cities and counties that will help take advantage of the opportunities that are being presented to us at this time that will also help with our climate issues. So anyway, any other questions? Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for Ms. Alexander. In your presentation or somewhere in there, I heard you talking about reducing meat consumption, eating more vegetables. I also heard reduction size of families in there and let's say we start going down that path and people decide, no, we actually don't want to do that. We like our meat and we like our large families. I have 7 children, one still in the womb. And in my district, that's not uncommon. And so what if people just don't get on board with that? What do we do? What's the solution then? Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. I really appreciate that question. So we approach this conversation from a place of abundance. We don't, you know, this isn't about what we have to give up, what we need to, you know, what we need to sacrifice. It's about the world that we want to build and live in together. We do not focus on population size as a climate solution. We focus on health and education for women and girls as a climate solution. That has, in developing countries where those rights do not exist for women, in places in Southeast Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa, where those rights do not exist, those have important implications. So we focus on the health and education of women and girls as the climate solution. It has the side effect of empowering women to be able to make whatever decisions about the size of their family they want. So there's no, that is, you know, that those are very distinct things, and our focus is on that we want to have a world where women and girls can choose, and they can choose with along with their families what they want for their what they want for their lives. And I think, you know, the meat question is a very challenging. You know, I think we're getting at the heart of really difficult things. And I think it's important not to shy away from them. I'm from my grandfather was a coal miner, and my grandfather on the other side was a steel worker in central Pennsylvania. So I see, you know, these are not black and white issues. And I appreciate that this committee is grappling with those issues head on. And, you know, we're providing sort of the mirror. What is the atmosphere showing us? Well, it's showing us where these emissions are coming from. What we do with that is up to us, right? So we're providing, you know, where the emissions are coming from, and then what potential solutions are. And it's up to us what to do with that. You know, I don't think anyone would say stop eating meat altogether. It's, you know, this is about sort of, we can move toward integrating more, you know, more plants and into our diet, and we can make those decisions for ourselves and our families and our communities.
And we'll do a quick follow up. We're running low on time. We've got another.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, great. Then they're just suggestions that won't be enforced. Then is your idea.
We are, I mean, we, yeah, we're, thank you, Representative. I don't think we would ever suggest enforcement of a meat limit. These have implications for farmers, for ranchers, for jobs, for, you know, we recognize that these are deeply embedded values and livelihoods for people around the world. So we're providing, you know, again, what the atmosphere is showing us, what potential solutions are, and it's up to different contexts, I think, to decide where to focus. There's lots of things to be done. If changing diets does not feel right for a community or for a family, great. There are other things to be done. Thank you.
And Representative, we've got just a couple minutes left, so we'll be quick through the last couple questions. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I've been reflecting on Representative Swedzinski's question about what can Minnesota do, what's the overall impact. Maybe Dr. Roop, if you were able to get everything that you would want, are we an island unto itself, or are we a part of a broader system around the Midwest and around the country?
Dr. Roop, sorry.
Chair Ekum, Representative, thank you for that question. No, we would not be an island. We might be an island that's leading the way or paving the path, but we are certainly surrounded by states and counties, and, I mean, you don't even have to look too far to see local jurisdictions that are leapfrogging the state and the federal government seeking to prepare and deploy solutions because it's what they desire for their communities. So I think, you know, to the point that there are, you know, historic federal investments and dollars to be had, I have here a great authority that the challenge is getting the money out the door to communities that need it. And so there are going to be communities around the nation, and hopefully in Minnesota, equipped and have the capacity and the resources to access those dollars to invest in solutions in their community. So I think as we pave the way, Minnesota is no doubt a leader in this space in our region. But there are other states in this nation that are ahead of us and that we can look to for examples. Their missteps can be our opportunities to leapfrog them. And as it's snowy outside, maybe it's not so bad to be an island in some cases, because you might have the waves lapping on the shore with the sunshine. A girl can dream. But I think everyone benefits from leadership, no more than Minnesotans when Minnesota leads. But the Midwest benefits, the nation benefits, and most certainly the world wins when we all choose to act.
And I want to let Representative Altendorf have the last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Larry had a follow-up.
Yeah, so just
sorry, 1 second.
My apologies. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think that some of the questions, when we ask what can Minnesota do, we also have to say, how many jobs will we build by doing this? What kind of industries can we help create? How much exporting of a technology will we do? How much additional health of our system, of our citizens, will we create? So I like the question, but I just view it that there's so much potential here for what we can do that I think that the answer, we have to think more broadly on the answer than just what is the impact of a few trying to isolate to what only the climate, the specific degree change is. It's a much broader impact. Thank you.
And we'll go quickly to
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you both of you for your expertise today. Really enjoyed so much of it. I just want to challenge this committee and to also say, you know, I hear contradictions, and oftentimes government, you know, we create a law or a mandate, and that creates another future problem. And a couple of the contradictions that I heard today was moving to plant-rich diets. And then at the same time, we were talking about moving to solar, and we were talking about moving thousands of our very rich agricultural land here in Minnesota into solar farms. And this is a huge concern of mine. So have we done the analysis on that, that as we are taking away our rich soil, that and we're moving to also at the same time saying we're moving to a plant-rich diet, how much extra land do we need to provide that plant-based diet? So that would be one thing. And I just really appreciate Representative Hollins, I think, brought up the agricultural impact. And this has to be a concern. We are, you know, one of the leading states in agriculture, and we cannot hurt that agriculture economy. It will affect the whole Minnesota economy. So we have to really walk and proceed carefully as we are making these very important decisions. But my question was, have you done an analysis when you move to that plant-rich diet, when you're moving us away from meat, you know, based, how much land, extra land do we need to provide for that?
Thank you for that question. And we'll give you just a really quick response if you can, and there'll be time you guys can connect afterwards if you want.
Great.
Representative, or excuse me, Ms. Alexander.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. That's the contradictions are everywhere, I think, is what I want to say. We need to transform every sector across every part of society and every part of the world. We are not, to the earlier question, we are not, you know, no one sector is an island. And this is a system of solutions that we need to integrate holistically, and that will look different in different places. Again, I think, you know, my job is to provide sort of the global picture of what the solutions are, and that will look different in different contexts based on values, based on capacities, based on skill sets, based on natural resources. But I think calling out that this is hard stuff, and this is there are inconsistencies to be grappled with is something that needs to happen at the local level, I think.
I want to thank both of our presenters for coming and being here today. I want to thank everybody for the great conversation, and we will meet again next Tuesday at 3 o'clock. And with that, we are adjourned. That's the word.